Disinformation continues to be a threat to Ukrainian sovereignty, but now more than ever is being targeted at Western democracies and the allies of Ukraine. And that is for a twin purpose. One is to try and encourage us not to support Ukraine to victory, not to supply the weaponry that is required for Ukraine, not just to survive, but to be victorious. The other part, of course, is to undermine electoral processes and even the concept of democracy in the Western societies. Information warfare threatens security, information security, social stability, and especially in states which Russia seeks to destabilize and which sees it as its natural enemies. And of course, we are in an election year. We have previously talked about the influence of disinformation on the 2016 US election, but now it feels like deja vu, and we are coming up to that point again. And now the outcome is more significant than ever. An isolationist US will have huge implications, not just for Ukraine, but also for the whole of Europe. So disinformation and information warfare is absolutely at the core of the discussions we should be having. Welcome to the Silicon Curtain podcast. Please like and subscribe and definitely comment against the videos, because it does help people discover the amazing guests that we feature on the channel. Please do also check out the validated Ukrainian charities in the description. It's never been more important than it is now to help Ukraine remain resilient and ensure they have the resources that they need to fight against Russian aggression. Valeria Kavtun is Deputy Project Director at the Zinc Network, a cognitive resilience program rolling out in Ukraine. Valeria was formerly head at Filter, the National Media Literacy Project, founded in Ukraine. She's also worked as a journalist at BBC Real and has been a senior correspondent at major Ukrainian news organizations. And I'm delighted to say as well that she's also been on Silicon Curtain twice. She was one of the first guests on the channel, and I'm really pleased to welcome her back again.
Thank you. There is always something to discuss. Disinformation is evolving, so we'll always have topics for your podcast.
And I think the news media very much focuses on the physical warfare, if it focuses at all, because we also know that Ukraine is dropped out of the headlines to an extent, unfortunately, despite the scale of the war, despite the significance of what's going on, and of course, despite the significance of Ukraine's commitment to democracy, which is something that really is massively important in world affairs and history. But we also know that Russia's warfare doctrine is only one part military, and actually the areas that supposedly are invested in more heavily even is the informational space. So do you think that has changed at all? And how much attention should we be paying to Russia's capabilities and resources around information warfare?
It has changed in a way that Russia definitely intensified its disinformation campaigns, not only in Ukraine, but all around the world. It's a big election year, so Russia's meddling with that a lot, and they have their very hidden tactics, which very often play well with people's overconfidence as to how they view their media literacy. There is a tendency, let's say, specifically men, it's a Ukrainian case, they tend to claim that they listen to various experts and they want a diversity of opinions, and they know that it doesn't impact them. But the human psychology is built in a way that even if you declare that something doesn't impact you, it doesn't necessarily mean so. So I think it's how Russian propaganda plays very well with this kind of mindset. And of course, Russia's it's present on various platforms, and the current developments I'm seeing is that it's way more active on TikTok and in the vertical format videos such as YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, which are meant to entertain and to serve as an escape space for Ukrainians and general audiences who are tired of news and rather avoid news. And that's the place where propaganda and disinformation can target them in their most vulnerable state, I'd say. There are many other ways Russia is intervening into other countries' political discussions. In Germany, as we know, AfD, in Latin America, they tap into local context by creating a network of semi-media outlets or like fake media outlets who tend to report on the situation on the ground, about the life of local communities, but in the end, in between, they share bits of Russian propaganda with regards to Ukraine. And it works super well because when you build trust with the community, it's much harder to feed in bites of disinformation and propaganda, as you probably already know and discussed.
Well, I was about to say that. I mean, this feeds into, because you'll know my day job is commercial propaganda and trying to pick apart the algorithms for commercial reasons, but we've been paying, you know, increasing attention to things like TikTok. And that's because, you know, commercial entities want to manipulate that and get their messages into these platforms. And quality is an extraordinarily important criteria. Google, as a traditional search engine, puts a huge onus on the veracity of information and the quality of information, the authority that underpins it. And we cannot find any equivalent in most social media platforms, but TikTok is like that, but on steroids. Rather, there it's trying to feed people what they want, and that can give rise to bubbles or ecosystems of information that are extremely distorted. I wonder, in your view, whether that happens by accident or whether actually this is also by design.
So clearly, some platforms invest more money into moderation and making sure there's some filters in place, and whereas others are probably don't see it as a priority. And if you look at X, it's definitely a platform where Russian bots and trolls would be more active, or like any agents that would want to undermine democracy, they would probably be most active there because they have less filters to spread their propaganda there. But when it comes to TikTok, I think it's both. I think one fact is that indeed Russia intensified its campaigns on TikTok, and I see myself, it's a massive tons of fake accounts moderated from Africa. You could even see on TikTok, it's publicly available, this information, which use the same type of content that are interconnected, that they post information like videos under same hashtags like corruption, Ukrainian MPs, everything that's meant to divide Ukrainian society and sow disbelief. They clearly increase their presence there. And because they use something that's already emotional by default, any emotional content that says about some conspiracy theories or like secretive information, something you would never hear from authorities in Ukraine, it sparks interest in the audience by default. And of course, it creates more views, leads to more comments. Sometimes I see them creating profiles and trying hard to like post similar videos on daily basis. And then at some point it works. You could clearly see the increase from 500 views to like 2 million views, because they keep trying and trying. And sometimes it depends on the time and the user activity. So I tracked, and there was an interesting research by Ukrainian organization Texty and also Ukrainian Institute of Mass Information, who clearly say there are ways how Russia produces propaganda videos with AI. They fake voice of famous Ukrainian TV presenters. They capitalize on famous media outlets, brands, and they post their fragments of their news bulletins, but in a completely distorted context with a deep fake, with a generated voice and with specific, very bright headlines and subtitles to grab users' attention. And we see the increase of this type of content on TikTok, not just TikTok. TikTok is might be a platform where it appears, but then it slowly moves to Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts, and you could see the same type of content being spread on various platforms. So I'd say this is indeed a change of the last couple of months.
That's absolutely fascinating. And of course, mixing prejudice and disinformation with entertainment actually comes from a long tradition, even if you go back to mainstream media and entertainment formats that would have been produced in the 90s and 2000s that came out of Russia and hugely influential in Ukraine as well. But what you're building, I think, is quite fascinating. And previously we talked about media literacy, which was the program you were involved in before. Now you're talking about a concept called cognitive resilience, and very much in relation to this sort of I would call it almost a hardcore addictive platforms like TikTok. What is this concept of cognitive resilience, and how can it help to really fight against this weaponized I was going information, but actually entertainment content?
Yeah, I think it's rather my personal observation. I see people talking more about psychological defense and different ways of to protect their societies from. It's not just disinformation anymore. It's much more than just a fake story, I think. As I said, it's Russia uses a number of methods. It can be this fake media outlets that build trust. It can be quite renowned Western experts who promote Russian propaganda narratives. Sometimes they do it knowingly, sometimes they do it not knowingly, but Russia uses the fragments, the context in which they say it, and multiplies this content, making sure that Russian audiences see it. They kind of believe that West is supportive of Russia through these fake experts or through the experts who indeed said something, but without understanding the consequences of them saying it. So it's a number of various methods, and Russia is good at using the local context very well. And I think we do not just focus on media literacy in this time, because media literacy is a lot about understanding how media works, engaging with media, responsibly sharing content, but especially when it comes to the Ukrainian context, it's a lot about psychological stability, about mental health, and the ability to act rationally at times when you're physically threatened and you are vulnerable emotionally. So I think that is the discussion now, and lots of countries have moved away from just media literacy to more overarching concepts of either cognitive resilience, which sounds a bit, to be honest, complicated, and we even when I test it with different audiences, seems like there's a bit of a struggle in terms of understanding cognitive part of this term. But when you say psychological defense or the defense from manipulations and the ability to detect manipulations, people are like, okay, actually, it's really very useful and it's really very much needed. Whereas media literacy, as I mentioned previously, it evokes a bit of a, it creates a bit of a, I don't know, boredom. People are just like, media literacy sounds very academic. I don't really feel how I can apply it in real life. But psychological defense is very, very relevant for the war context. And especially if you are threatened on a daily basis. Today, we had a massive rocket attacks again on Ukraine. In this state, when you are unsure whether you'll be able to survive, whether your family will be safe, you need psychological resilience. And I think what I prefer myself is the word resilience, and it encompasses many different facets, where I think resilience to disinformation plays a huge role too.
And this is a fascinating area because fact checking or media literacy emerges from some of the early experiments in counter disinformation like fact checking, but as we go through, it plays an important role, but its ability to reshape the narrative and, as you say, to provide resilience to people is negligible. And in fact, it's far too easy to ignore it because the fact checking usually moves at a slower pace than the initial lie, and people have sort of moved on. So that's a technique that plays a role, but it doesn't counter the holistic nature of disinformation propaganda. When it comes to what you're doing, how important are things like cultural values and belief in things like democracy and, genuine values people may hold that are coming under attack or being undermined? Is this resilient process also a part of people being able to hold on to their values that gives them some kind of certainty? and fight against those that would seek to undermine and destroy a much more sort of cultural identity or values-based system.
For sure, fact checking is it needs to continue. We can't live without fact checking. It's a fundamental thing for any country. And the more fact checking organizations we have, the better. I think they proved themselves in the first few months of the war. I think they had all the necessary expertise in place to debunk and all the Russian disinformation 24/7. But it's not the only way of tackling disinformation, and I believe in this concept that you mentioned, that we need to invest in values and a clear understanding of what are we standing for, and that every person in the society can have the personal agency to bring a change. And I think that's a bit of a struggle, or not a struggle, but rather a vulnerability that many European old democracies in Europe have, is that after many years of having democratic freedoms for granted, they just got so used to it that now they don't see the necessity to stand for it. And I think it's important for the governments to remind from time to time that it's not something that needs to be taken for granted. And there's a war happening in the middle of Europe, which is basically the war for these values. And I quite like Estonian model of psychological defense, where they put values in the core, and then everything else is just around this main kind of idea of democratic values. Same with Ukraine. It's not, I think I like to reread Ukrainian history quite often myself. Part of the result of that is the project that we launched with the former team of Filter, is the project called We Are Here, which aims to explain Ukrainian history and culture in a kind of bite content in a more like simple manner, but based on facts and on expertise from historians. And whenever you reread it, or whoever would reread the Ukrainian history, they notice a very consistent effort from Russia to undermine Ukrainian identity, to destroy any cultural heritage, to create their own reality, to physically destroy and kill Ukrainian artists, poets, whoever who would advocate for existence of Ukrainian statehood, nationhood, Ukrainian language and culture. And we very often tend to overlook culture and history, and we think it's something more for entertainment and fun, but in fact it's a very, very strong base for many nations, because without knowing what we are standing for, without remembering how many times the Ukrainian society was exposed to massive murders from Russia, from the Soviet Union back then, from Russian Empire, without remembering it's very easy to give up and say, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where our borders are and who's in charge. But in fact, it does. And very often, when we dive deeper into history and we find stories worth sharing and worth emphasizing, such as the massive famine in Ukraine, artificially organized by Stalin, or massive relocation of Ukrainians to blend them with Russians, or any other massive murders that were happening throughout centuries on the Ukrainian land, with the main goal to completely destroy Ukrainian identity, then people have this aha moment and they say, okay, it seems like my ancestors have been fighting for so many decades. They died because they were not happy to put up with this regime, and they wanted their freedom and they wanted their liberties. Why should I be the kind of weakling and the kind of the least resilient person in this whole chain of events, so that I would undermine the whole history that was happening before me? And I think it creates a very strong understanding as to why we need to stand as a nation. And this is Actually, a very weak spot right now that Russia uses a lot in their propaganda campaigns. And I keep hearing this phrase, what are we fighting for? If there is corruption, if there is not enough support from the Western allies, and it's very easy to use this vulnerability for Russian propaganda because that's something that's already there. So part of our efforts is to keep reminding Ukrainians that it's not new, that nothing will change if the negotiations have never worked. So there should be a different way for you to stay resilient. And here are some of the role models, some of the very bright examples of Ukrainian artists, political figures who stayed resilient and who can inspire you. So we do that. And to be honest, sometimes when I reread history, you don't really need to invent anything. Just read history that's written in a very clear manner, which, like, without too many complications, because very often it's the case. But if you read a history that's written by a professional historian, you will feel it yourself. You don't really need to read complicated academic papers proving you something. It's there. So we just need to find the right stories to share. And I think at this stage, Ukrainians also need more stories of how they're not forgotten and how the Western world still keeps helping them and how they're still empathetic, because the feeling of abandonment, the feeling that you're left out, is not contributing to the general desire to win. So I think this is the resilience to me. It's no longer just fact-checking, because disinformation is much more complex than just taking something out of the context and presenting it in a different light. No, it's about this whole sense of disbelief, this all kind of question, what are we fighting for? And I think we really need to look at Russian propaganda through this lens, not just through fact checking.
And that's interesting. That makes a connection there with something I discussed in an interview I did yesterday. And that is a certain tendency, certain people who are looking at the appointment or the tentative appointment of General Valery Zaluzhny to the point of ambassador in the UK. Some people looking at it through an internal political lens, almost a peacetime lens. If you speak to many Ukrainians and they say, like, I don't understand why they've done this. You know, he's being isolated. But actually, you could argue the reverse is true, that you're taking one of the most visible and eloquent and strong figures that represents Ukrainian resilience, and he's going to have a big role on the European stage and with one of the largest allies, keeping Ukraine top of mind and projecting that sort of resilience and that idea you've just said there, that we're not forgotten. It will help to emphasize that.
Yeah, there are many ways to look at it. I am not inside of the Ukrainian government, so I can't say what was the motivation for it. But part of the resilience and part of this whole framework of psychological defense or cognitive resilience is also communication and the media environment and strategic comms environment. And it's probably also led by, not probably, it's 100% led by the Ukrainian government in general. So we clearly need to learn to communicate things better, because communication, which is again often overlooked or not considered to be a priority in the wartime, but as the first few months of the full-scale invasion proved, communication is key. When Zelensky appeared in front of a multi-million audience saying that I'm here and I've never left and I'm going to stay here till and do whatever it takes, it was a very, very clear sign, and it was very much welcomed by the Ukrainian society. And then the regular updates from the president, one voice policy from the Ukrainian government, it all is important for the Ukrainian society to stay resilient, because if there is diversity of voices and opinions and they're not in line with each other, I'm not talking about preventing someone from sharing something because it's wartime. I think Ukraine balances quite well its democratic efforts with the necessity to sometimes restrict certain things in the war context. But if there is no kind of understanding as to where we are moving as a nation, like as a state authority. What is our one policy for communicating things? What's our direction? If people are lost in this comms environment and they can't communicate things clearly to the general publics, it creates confusion. And confusion is a ground for the propaganda. Whenever there is confusion and dissatisfaction as to how the Ukrainian authorities communicate in certain critical moments, Russia is there to come up with new ideas and promote the messages they want to promote. So I think it's values is important, but values is in the core, but then there's everything else around. Fact-checking is part, but then strategic comms is another part, and strategic comms should incorporate pre-bunking techniques where the local authorities, governmental institutions should be able to warn the Ukrainian society as to which campaigns can be happening in the past. They should be able and they must know how to build this trust. And trust is something that is not coming in one day. It's something that our nations require, states require years and hundreds of years to build. And I think when the full-scale invasion started, the level of trust to the governmental authorities increased massively, specifically trust to the president. And it is proven by numerous surveys and the research shows. Now the trust is declining. And with a declining trust, there is a growing disinformation. So I probably lost the question that you asked me.
No, it's perfect. I mean, that's a really comprehensive answer, which puts it in a wider context. And your project, Mitut, we're here. How is that going to scale up? How does that get this very important concept across of the importance of history and being grounded in context? How does that scale up to actual individuals in the population, different demographics, age groups, and people of perhaps different political persuasions?
So for now, it's a project that runs with people who are volunteers. So they pitch their ideas and they send us the articles. We work with historians as well, where they, you know, again, pitch their ideas and we make sure that the texts that they write are digestible for mass audiences. The idea is that we actually, I'm very happy that it's becoming a part of many media outlets' agenda. I think I noticed myself that many of the news outlets in one way or another start talking about debunking myths, diving deeper into history. There is a huge project called MUR in Ukraine that reconsiders the Ukrainian history through very artsy perspective by creative songs and musicals. And I think that's the way to teach young generations our history, and it works very well. Our project Mytut, which is literally translated as "We Are Here," echoing the phrase that Zelensky said at the beginning of the full-scale invasion, "We are here, we've never left." So for us, it's kind of very symbolic. We, for now, work with mainly younger audience, Gen Z and millennials, because they seem to be most active. And from my previous experience working with younger people, it's something that you receive. It's like you invest and you can quickly receive the feedback and the results of your work, because they do not just consume the information you provide, they act. That you can not only change their attitudes with the content, but you can also change their behavior much faster than with older people, from my experience. So very often when we communicate with younger people, we see them sharing these materials, participating in various activities, sharing these activities with their peers. So I think it's the audience that's most rewarding. But of course, it's hard to invest in everyone at the same level. But for us, it's probably the priority for now. We would like to scale up. We would like to work more with regional content creators. As you know, Ukraine is a huge country. I'm coming from the north of Ukraine. Some of my colleagues come from the western Ukraine. And we often are so unaware as to the history of our regions or the culture of our regions. So creating this exchange of between different regions where people can feel that they are heard, that their voices are heard, is important. And then creating some sort of dialogues is also part of building resilience in Ukraine.
And a previous interview we did with the editor of Ukraina, that's another publication which helps to bring to life the visual aspects, at least, of different regions of Ukraine. Well, let's turn to the opposite here, which is the ongoing weaponization of information. Because on the one hand, you're trying to create a world of complex, truthful, and nuanced information that can ground people and give them immunity or resilience against disinformation. At the same time, the tools on the other side to scale up lies and manipulations are accelerating with the advent of AI and some of the things you talked about earlier, sort of deep fakes and sort of conglomerating together various sources to try and create something that sort of almost looks like an official media publication, but which is shot through with lies. And then the technique, of course, will then amplify that around. So you may not consume it firsthand, but you hear it through second, third hand, and the megaphone of social media. With the advent of AI and the era we're in, which is iterative AI, which is getting more and more intelligent at reacting to how people consume this information, what's the real threat here? Because my impression is that AI is going to be as bad as the malign influence or the malign intent behind those that wield it. Therefore, it's nearly infinite. If you look at the malign intent that comes out of the Kremlin, there's almost no limits to what that is. And finally, they'll have a tool that can express the full extent of that malignancy.
I don't think I can add much to the discussion. To be honest, there's been so much has been said already and so much has been done. But I think it's very often that we address AI as like a self-standing body or like some evil that that works in isolation, which is not the case. It's an instrument and it depends who uses it and which are the regulations, what are the who's playing with this instrument. Some people even said in the past that increasing media literacy means also that you're increasing media literacy of potential baddies, like bad agents who's gonna be there and post content on X and be the propaganda reports of propaganda. So you can look at everything from that perspective. I'm a bit more positive and more optimistic myself. I think that AI can be extremely helpful in identifying disinformation, and we see numerous Ukrainian startups already using AI to help the Ukrainian fact-checking organizations and NGOs to detect manipulations and spread the word about it. AI helps Ukrainian startups and other organizations to collect information about the vulnerabilities of the Ukrainian audiences faster and identify these vulnerabilities and work with them or help the government identify these vulnerabilities. So I think there is also a lot of potential. One important aspect of all that is the communication and warnings from the government. I see that the UK government is already doing it, warning of potential manipulations regarding the elections that can be coming from AI, which is great. I think this is the work that needs to be done, and probably governments need to develop their own set of policy recommendations as to how they communicate these potential threats, how often they do it, in which manner. This is important. But in general, I think AI literacy is joining media literacy efforts these days, and it should be part of curriculum. I think Finland is already doing it, as always, one of the most advanced nations when it comes to media literacy. And they incorporate AI in the academy, in the school curriculum. And it seems like it's working. I clearly know that there is a danger as to how distrustful we might become. But if we always look at AI in the negative light and we sow this fear and we kind of warn people that AI is going to be everywhere and you should be careful and do not trust whatever you see on the internet, this creates the distrust, which is again a very good ground for Russian propaganda to work with. Distrustful people are very easy are very prone to conspiracy theories, and it's much easier to manipulate those who do not trust anything. And looking back at history of Russia, they specifically targeted intellectual Russians, like those who had few degrees and those who knew a couple of languages. They targeted them with the message that, you know, you can watch any media abroad. You can watch BBC. How do you know that BBC is not lying to you? Okay, maybe Russia Today is lying. We don't deny it. But anyone else is also, you know, can be a liar. So this is a very dangerous tactic. And I think we shouldn't communicate AI as the evil itself, but we should rather empower people and say, look, you should just be aware what you shouldn't do with AI, because this is unethical. But also, there are so many possibilities for you to improve your skill sets, to improve your critical thinking with the help of AI. And this is how to do it.
And another aspect, we will touch on this in a future sort of conversation. As we've been doing these interviews, it's become clearer and clearer. And actually, the whole point of this channel is to create a continuous output, is to match propaganda in terms of its cadence of content output, and also have repetition, because propaganda repeats things over and over and over again, almost in a kind of mantra or brainwashing approach. So, you know, I think it's important to do episodes on the same topic and endlessly find different angles, but come back to them again and again and again, because otherwise it slips from people's consciousness. So that's a conscious effort. And what we're doing is essentially creating alternative reality, an alternative reality which at least has the intention to be more fact-led and reality-led, rather than to consciously manipulate and deceive. So if we turn to sort of the idea of creating products, not just techniques and narratives, but actual product to create a reality that counters, you know, the reality that manipulations and propaganda are creating, how important are things like 20 Days in Mariupol, the film that's come out recently? Because this presents a visceral, complex, and highly sort of, realistic view of what's going on. It's obviously documentary format, but it's incredibly kind of powerful and immediate. Are these essential kind of things to do and to create and to put out into the information sphere as a way of countering manipulated propaganda narratives and propaganda product?
I think it's a bit of a slippery path to say that we create reality, because there is one reality. Mariupol happened. This is not us creating the reality. The film is a reflection of that reality. It's just putting the reality into a digestible format for different audiences. Russia creates not reality, it creates its illusionary world. It creates a world which it wants to believe in, but it's not this world. It's just how it wants it to be, but it's not the reality. It just creates something. So I think it's some discussions I often have with my friends and colleagues as to whether there is concept of truth or not. Same here, I believe. So there is actual reality based on facts, and there is created world, which is non-existent. It's just purely artificially made up. So I think the movie is a great way to remind the world that the war is happening. As it was rightly noted, everyone wishes in Ukraine we wouldn't have had this Oscar. We just don't want it this way. But I think this is exactly what international audiences need. This is a very cruel, brutal reality that Ukrainians survived and they live in it. And unfortunately, there is not enough of this representation of this reality in the news media, news outlets in the media these days. So this movie, it's like a punch in the face as a reminder that it's not over yet. Sadly, it's very often, you know, covered in this, it's something that Ukrainians might find a bit surreal in many ways, because many of them still shelter, they still spend their nights in bomb shelters. And then there's the whole new world with Hollywood stars, celebrities celebrating the awards and celebrating the movie, which is actually about suffering. It's just hard on a mental level. It's hard to digest how these two worlds can coexist. But my stance is that we do not need to question things. This is the world we live in. We just I mean, we just need to be persistent and we need to find ways and tools that work for different audiences. I very often traveling in between Ukraine, UK and Europe, I see that there is a very, understandably, there's a sense of disillusionment, a sense of unfairness, not from the Ukrainian side. But it creates a bubble where Ukrainians with their own traumas tend to validate their traumas. But when you go outside of the bubble and you talk to Western audiences who's missing the context, who might understand certain pains, but not all the pains, who might be empathetic, but not understand the depth of the pain and where it comes from, it can be frustrating for Ukrainians to deal with this. And it creates tension and aggression between international audiences and Ukrainians. Is this the right way to promote Ukrainian narratives? No, it's not. Because if something is built on aggression, it's not going to go anywhere. So I'm taking the stance that one needs to use the tools that work. And if it doesn't make you feel right at this point, because your pain is so strong and you feel like no one else understands it, leave it for later. I think it's going to be a time when Ukraine will need to recover and deal with all the mental traumas that we are going through now. But at this stage, the goal is to win. The goal is to come out as a democratic society and creating fights with people who can potentially be your supporters and who can advocate for this victory is counterproductive. So I think the movie is a great way to do it. It's a great way to remind it. But as you said, and you rightly noted, it needs to be repetitive. It's not enough. Movie is on the news agenda a couple of days or maybe weeks or maximum months, but we need to produce more. And I think Ukraine is very capable of producing very strong and powerful content. It's just very often that we lack this lens, we lack the context that with which international audiences work. And I think it's sometimes where we need help from international experts and comms experts from abroad.
And of course, one area which Russian propaganda excels at is to create artificial disputes, is to create people who may appear to be organic actors, political players, and then get them to say, you know, radical things, attack allies, attack each other. And I won't mention any names, but I think we probably all know who we're talking about here, a sort of marginal figure in Ukrainian politics, which very much fits that mold of really, you know, creating divisive conversations. It's a very effective Russian strategy. Now, that kind of thing, plus the other manipulations we've talked about, this is the sort of last question here, but we see Russia moving to a war economy footing. We see it retooling its education system, its administration, its industry, or what's left of its industry, to entirely bend it towards Putin's perverted mythical historical objectives and strategic objectives, which is aggression and domination. Now, what is the implication for information warfare? Because if they're scaling up and tooling up militarily, this implies that they will be doing an equivalent process to build up and make their informational warfare more aggressive even than it was previously.
I'm very worried myself. And I'm particularly worried about the children in Russia now, because when the war is over, we will still have to deal with millions of children who were exposed to a Russian view of the world, which has nothing to do with reality, unfortunately. And I think now Russia intensified its propaganda in the schools. All the schools operate on the sense of fear, and it's absolutely catastrophic what is happening there now. And with little access from the outside world, I think it's a very dangerous, not just for Ukraine but for the whole Europe, to have a neighbor like this. Look at Sweden. They started talking about the potential of war, which is something that never happened before. I feel like the nations start feeling a need to have some sort of wake-up call for like the governments. They want to emphasize that, come on guys, just don't be chill. It's no longer, you're no longer safe. No one is safe. The war has been happening for many years with no end. And I think it's really very, very dangerous that there is no transformation happening in Russia. The people who could potentially be the drivers of change, they are either abroad in Russia, but even abroad, they are still paralyzed by fear, which creates some, you know, lack of voices in there. I'm actually thinking, and I've discussed that a lot with historians as well, that it might be later on in the future, it might be part of Ukraine's responsibility to re-educate Russia. Whether we want it or not, we have this neighbor and we will have this huge country with imperialistic ambitions for the rest of our lives. So it might be a part of our recovery processes to also re-educate Russians and make sure that they understand what they've done and they feel the guilt that they need to feel, because it's not just important for us, for the democratic societies all around the world, but also for Ukrainians who suffered enormous loss. I think without the understanding that Russia regrets what it did, and that millions of Russians understand that they were responsible for massive killings. It's not just this one soldier who kidnapped a child, abducted a kid. It's the whole society that failed at building civic society, that failed at organizing fair elections, that failed at many democratic processes. And they want, we Ukrainians, just for their own sake, for their own mental well-being and for their ability to move on, they need to understand that this society recognizes its mistakes. And I think only once it's done, then Ukrainians can look into how they can contribute to potentially building this society in Russia who they want to be neighbors with. But before this happens, I think all the efforts need to be put into winning the war. And winning the war is only possible when we have a clear understanding in mind why we are doing it, what we are standing for, what's our cultural background, what's our history, and why we don't want this history to repeat. And we do not, I mean, Ukrainians more or less understand it, but they clearly need to be reminded. But the Western audiences also need to be reminded that it's not just Ukraine's war, it's a war which protects some values that they might already be taking for granted for many, many years, but it's not gonna be a status quo if they just keep being passive.
That's an incredibly important thought to end on. Valeria, thank you so much. Again, it's a huge privilege to be able to gain access to your incredible insight and experience. And I love the fact that, you know, you're not just talking about this theoretically, you're running experiments, you're running projects that constantly test these hypotheses with real people and the impact this has on them and creating this resilience. Thank you so much for the work you do. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.